Hello, everyone. This is episode 47 of the Dresden Files podcast. And once again, we're going to be talking about the Cinder Spires because we actually don't care about the Dresden Files anymore. I mean, seriously, he hasn't come out with a book in a while, so why should we care anymore? Although I have heard that Briefcases is in beta, so that'll be fun whenever that drops.
Woo!
Briefcases. So, give it to me. Give it to me.
It's like 6+ months, right? So I think, was it? Cold Days was like one of the shortest he did, and that was like 3 months. So, and who knows if it's different for all the short stories, but I'm saying Christmas. That's my prediction. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, and the little details we know about the story is that it's in Harry's point of view and Maggie's point of view and Mouse's point of view. It's like the same story within three different perspectives, which happens a lot in stories, and it's a lot of fun. But I didn't think we were ever going to get anything in Mouse's point of view.
I mean, how much could he hurt, really?
But he said that Mouse knew not too much. So, like, how do we get anything in Mouse's point of view? Like, I love it because I want to know whatever Mouse knows. But damn, surprising me.
I'm super excited.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. And if it's a Christmas present, that's great too. But just like, I'd like some more peace talks, please.
Yeah, like all of
but
it.
But we also, we do also have Fistful of Warlocks that came out on 4th of July, and we're going to discuss that one soon. So if you haven't read it already, please read it so we don't spoil everything, because it's a big one. And I think that's the last of the news, other than I think Jim is still doing the touring with all the various Comic Cons. And
You know what Jim is still doing? Jim is still not done with the next book.
That's why we're talking about the other book.
If you haven't read all the short stories, I promise that will hold you over about this much longer.
Yeah.
I think I've read all of them. Except the new one.
Really?
Yeah, the new Untitled Brief Talks, or are you talking about Fistful of Warlocks?
So you did Fistful Day 1 and Jury Duty and Curses.
I did Jury Duty. I don't think I've gotten the one with Butters yet, actually.
Okay. Day 1.
Butters one. And the one with Molly before she becomes Winter thing, like how she gets her apartment and stuff. I think that's the one.
Okay, yeah, those are pretty good in their own right. And you know, when you read them all together, it's like, did you like Side Jobs? You're gonna love Briefcases. So
I'm just not gonna bother with the ones I haven't read yet.
Do we know that? Will Briefcases be out before Peace Talks?
Yes.
I don't know.
I think that, so the plan was he was going to finish the last short story and get that out because that would hopefully hold people over while he scrambled to finish Peace Talks, because theoretically he's now in his house, I guess, is what everybody else's fan theory is. But Priscilla hasn't exactly confirmed that, and she's like our main source other than him. So hint, Priscilla, if you're listening, because I know you watch every show, just saying.
Yeah, we're important enough that Priscilla cares.
Why haven't we had her on yet? We should do something about that.
We should.
Okay, we'll try. Let's talk about Cinder Spires so that we don't go crazy over our lack of information about Dresden Files. So let's go crazy about lack of information about Cinder Spires, like the fact that we really don't know much about all of the Spires, but we don't. Aren't really sure about any of their cultures. We can kind of make guesses. Like, so we've got Albion, which is very British. Okay. We've got Aurora, which we think is Spanish. We have Olympia, Piper, Delosia, Atlanta, Nephesis, and then there's also Ethogia and Jerizi. I've got a few notes about all of these, but not much. I've taken them directly from the wiki because I hope they knew more than I did.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. Like, I thought only like four were referenced in the book, and then I saw your list and it's like, holy shit, you know, like, so the Mishark, they fly Delosian colors. So that's how we know about them.
Is she Olympian or is she Delosian also, like, ethnically?
She might be Olympian. I know that Olympia gets mentioned both with the Olympian Commodore that they meet in the inn. And then also, I mean, obviously the next book is titled that, but they did some Olympian race. Like, that's where the Mishark predator thing happened.
Yeah.
So,
and it just,
and that's
like,
why I was surprised that they were running with somebody else's colors. And it's like, well, wait. So,
unless she is Delosian, whatever that means, we don't know anything about their culture, just the fact that she has their colors. Right. And she's a tall redhead.
And going with the theme so far, like what I should do and probably should have done for this is go research those names, because Aurora, you know, we were saying last time, kind of seems to tie itself into Spain a little bit. Albion was like the original name for London or for the island. Was that
the entire
what it was?
Island of Britannia?
Right. So it's stuff like that where it's like maybe you've got to get pretty deep. I mean, Jim loves his history. That's part of why he's so good at making all the folklore fit, is that he does enough research to be dangerous. And so these answers are out there, I'm sure. But yeah, I have no idea.
The flag colors are a white star upon a bisected red and blue field. That doesn't sound like any particular flag that I'm aware of. But I think one of the things I thought that Captain Ransom was Olympian is that her name is Calliope, which sounds kind of Greek.
Right.
Is this, I don't know, but I don't see anything else that comes up under the word Delosia.
Right.
Other than apparently it's the name of a shoe.
I wonder if after Brexit, the UK will go back to Albion, you know, back to their roots.
Yeah.
Since everyone's leaving the UK, you know, Scotland will leave if they don't get to stay in Europe.
Well, then we'll just go back to like Monty Python, right? King of the Britons, King of the Who. So,
I mean, Albion's a cool name, to be fair. Sounds better than
honestly. It is. And I like the fact that it is one of those obscure things that you really got to know it. Olympia is a little obvious because, you know, Greek mythology is like the second most popular mythology out there after like folk and fairy tales and stuff, right? So that one's not hard to guess at. Like Piker,
I'm guessing
have
they
no
still have the
idea.
Olympics. Okay, Piker, I'm thinking is like another form of England because the Picts were a thing in England.
Okay.
And they're kind of like the Welshy people. I think that, yeah, they're described as lean and worn looking, and their faces marked with a kind of fine spiraling ritual scar patterns, which kind of reminds me of those, or the Gauls, which were more Frankish instead of English.
Well, and part of the impression...
Do we know their Caucasian? Those would be like... American,
I think they're Caucasian because others are described as dark. Therefore, they're not described skin color-wise. I'm going to assume they're whitish.
Oh,
that's how much we care. So
I wonder what Alex would have to say about that.
Right. It's something institutionalized, you get the gist. So well, and part of the thing I got from the Pikers though is that they seem to be like a poor spire, that like the only thing they had worth trading was honey. And I thought that was part of why they were like small and lean, is it made it seem like their spire was all but failed, you know, in a sense where it's like they might have the necessities to take care of themselves, but even worse off than Aurora is intoned, where Aurora and they're poor and starving because their politicians are corrupt is really what the answer is.
Well,
you know,
I don't know if they're poor because one, honey is awesome, mm-hmm. and the other two is
I'm just thinking, how are they frail and thin if they are living off honey? Wouldn't they be fat and diabetic?
Well, there's also just like how much care and like difficulty there is in keeping bees that Gwen mentioned. It's like, oh wow, the monks have bees in their things. Like, how can they have it so stable for them? So I guess that requires a lot of, maybe not affluence, but resources in order to keep the bees making honey.
Could be, yeah.
Why is it, I can't remember this exactly, about why is it Aurora, not Aurora, by Albion, has so much more access to wood? Because the Aurorans think it's very affluent. And for them at the bottom, because they're close to the surface, I guess. But so would the other spire be. Why do they not have lots of wood?
It could be climate, you know, it could be balls. It could be the fact that Lord Albion's apparently not afraid of sending criminals down to the surface to chop wood, you know, or to work at the foot of the surface, which is what they were talking about doing with the crew of Itasca, and Grimm stepped in on their behalf. So that's, I mean, think about it. The Brits started an entire continent by taking all their criminals and shipping them somewhere. So it's not really outside of their, you know, their history to build an empire on the backs of slaves and convicts, you know? So it could be something like that, but like, it's never really addressed. And in my mind, I kind of romanticized it as that, you know, similar to like the gusto of the Verminositors or other people, is that maybe the people of, was it Habel Landing, right? Maybe they're just more ballsy. You know, they were just like, you know what? We could be here in squalor while Habel Morning has all the glory and everything, or we could fucking do something about it. You know, so I have no idea, but that's kind of what came to my mind. That's my headcanon, I guess.
Yeah, because I was just like, it was not really explicitly said one way or the other. But it is said that they are very like, you know, look at this, they're using wood for buildings and shit. Like, they have whole buildings made of wood. This is insane.
Right.
So, but it was never really said why they treasured wood so much. And we, because we're from the point of view of Albion, don't.
Well, part of it is, it's twofold. I mean, first of all, even from Gwen and Bridget, you get the idea that the books in the library are priceless beyond just the knowledge printed on them. The paper alone was a fortune.
Yeah.
And so they do respect it. It's just that's how rich Habel Landing is. And for what the real question is why do the Aurorans not have access to such wood? And the other thing is maybe they do, but again, the sergeants and major and whatnot of the Auroran Marines, they kind of get these little digs in about, you know, the corrupt and, you know, whatever the word is, but the Albions are basically like flaunting their wealth, right? But on the other side, you get a couple of digs from the Albions saying like, you know, it really sucks what happens to Aurora because their leading class basically squanders and hoards all the wealth, which, I mean, the aristocrats in Albion are probably doing as well. The Lancasters are certainly like holding back a little bit in the crystals, I would imagine, and kind of camping on their treasure there, but yeah, exactly. But you know, like it seems like in Aurora, like all of the luxury goods are pretty much under the control of their ruling class, whatever that is. That was the impression I got.
Which is like, in if the Aurorans are supposed to be Greek,
no, we're pretty sure that they're Spanish based on some of their namings.
Who's supposed to be Greek then? There was someone who was
Olympians.
Olympians, yeah.
Well. Yeah. Also, maybe Atlanta? There's the Atlanteans, which it sounds Greek to me, but yeah. Otherwise I don't know.
Well, and so the catch there is it's twofold, right? So like your note here, so Atlanteans have very dark skin and ice blue eyes. Their fleet uniforms are indigo. So like dark skin kind of implies some kind of, you know, African lineage in my mind. So I'm thinking like the White Walkers, but black. You know, like they're that black with the ice blue eyes, and there isn't a people that I'm aware of that does that. So it kind of throws you because they could be, what's the, oh crap, Roman history with Hannibal and his armies. Where were they from?
Carthage.
Carthage. Thank you. I was like C-A-L something. No. So yeah, so they could be Carthaginians and they're still Mediterranean area. Right. Mm-hmm. Or they could be like, I mean, it could be literally Atlanta for all I know, but I don't know any ice blue and certainly not a people that would create a population like that, you know? So,
yeah, I mean, they could be kind of like the Indo-Aryan type of like what you find in Turkey or Iran is like, you get a lot of darker skinned people with interestingly colored lighter eyes, but not all of them are blue. So it's interesting that it's that kind of a selection. Or I wonder if maybe, like, is this, like, people from the hidden world of Atlanta?
That's what I was thinking.
Well, I mean, and he does throw you that third bone by saying they're Atlanteans, woo, and Atlantean is also the Greek form of it, right? Because, you know, Plato. So all of that stuff. So, yeah, it's like, I would say, I mean, if I had to guess, the better bet would be that they're somewhere in the Mediterranean area. You know, maybe they are Carthaginians or some neighboring area like that. But again, it's not any people that I'm aware of. And after, you know, thousands and thousands of years, maybe somehow they, you know, shaped that way. Like, or maybe they use spice and that's why their eyes are blue, you know, so.
crossing genres there.
Well, I haven't seen that movie in such a long time.
It's also a book. It's not a very long book either. So, well, it's lots of books. So if you just stop at the one, then it's easy. But
right. Maybe there was a catch.
But, you know, just stop at the one, and then if you want to, then you can continue. But I don't know. Dune is pretty good, sort of. I don't know. I kept getting really confused of whether I was enjoying it or not until the end. It's like, it was worth it, I think.
Am I enjoying this right now? I'm not sure. I'll keep going. I'm into
Dune. Yeah, that's pretty much how it was. But then there's another spire called Nephesis, which it sounds like a Greek word, but it really reminds me of the Egyptian goddess Nephthysis that was the wife of Set. And they're described as having golden brown skin. The women wear long sweeping skirts in multiple layers, patterns, and colors. Which doesn't sound very Egyptian.
Right. It sounds somewhat Native American to me, you know.
But that word does not.
Right. Yeah. So again, we're pulled in like two directions at least and don't really have enough to go on.
I mean, they seem kind of Eastern Indian in terms of their dress, but also the word, still not Indian sounding to me.
That could be.
Let's see if that word pops up on Google.
Right.
That isn't the wiki.
Yeah, the other thing though is, like, especially with the airships, theoretically, if it is roughly the same layout as our world, like the only thing they really talk about on the surface is being jungle. So, you know, are there oceans in this world? And if there are, like, if it is in the similar layout to ours, like, you know, are we crossing the Mediterranean? Are we crossing the Atlantic? Because theoretically it's as easy to cross those oceans other than maybe weather than it would be over the forests because, you know, they're so high up in the atmosphere anyway. So, I mean, the spires themselves are 10,000 feet in the air, you know, so they're pretty much 2 miles high. You know, so you're basically talking about giant cubes in a way. And so the airships theoretically operate at 2 miles and up in most cases because of the mist. So yeah, there's a lot to think about, like how far does this range? If we are talking from the Atlantic coast out to like India, which I would assume Western India, maybe Pakistan, somewhere in there, you know, that's a pretty far range that these guys have been covering in those ships.
Those are all good thoughts, but I don't really have anything to comment on because we don't have enough to back anything up with. It's right. Just infuriating, but I don't know. And then there's other two spires, Ethogia and Gerizi, which we know nothing about other than their names. Ethogia reminds me of Ethiopia, just because of the way it looks. And Gerizi sounds like jalfrezi, which is like a Gurkish northern Indian food. Makes me think they're Indian too. But that's literally all I've got.
Right. And that, I agree on the Ethiopia thing. So yeah, almost certainly, you know, two or three of these spires are, you know, they are different cultures like that. They aren't all just like Western European something, which is going to be nice. So that'll provide some nice color, for lack of a better word. But I was thinking contrast or something at least. But I'm kind of excited. I mean, we're going as far as Greece, though, potentially in the next book. And so that's why I think we're going to get a huge, more like a wider view of the world, because we're going to see, like, we're seeing the world centered on Albion now. Next, we're going to see the world centered on Olympia. And while it is it is Western European, and in our world, it's the heart of Western European culture in a way, like it's where it all spawned. For them, they're the center of a different world, you know, the difference of Northern Atlantic versus the Mediterranean and whatnot. It's pretty substantial. So maybe we'll get a better view of some of these other cultures at a little bit.
I noticed that in our list of spire names, we don't have anything that's noticeably East Asian, Southeast Asian, like Vietnamese, Cambodian, Chinese, Japanese.
Right. And there, I mean, this, again, assuming roughly analogous to our world, there could be 100 reasons, or, you know, yeah. So I have so many theories that it's not funny, but one of the things talking about kind of the socio-political geography of what we're talking about here, one of the main things is that we're not really projecting power like we used to, right? They do talk about, in some cases, it seems at least implied that spires can come under other people's control. So it's not 100% unheard of what the Aurorans are doing. But other than that, it's not like you just go and claim land. So none of these countries are necessarily bigger than others. They are literally confined to their spire. So you don't have to worry too much about invading other people's airspace comparatively, because I'm sure they projected out, you know, dozens of miles or maybe 100 miles or something like that because of their airships. But it's not like the borders are the same. And then on the east side, if we assume similar population densities and spires are based on population density, then maybe you've got hundreds of Eastern Asian spires, and they're all busy with each other because they're too close together. You know, I don't know. There's just so much to speculate on there. I hadn't really thought that far myself.
Yeah, are we assuming that all of the spires are the same size? Because I guess we have been. And therefore, we have like a kind of a population cap based on just how many people you can fit into a spire. Unless you do what Habbo Landing did, is literally make one land thing to two by using wood, which obviously has to do like a lot of money because wood is hard to get. And then it's like the spires were made by very specific people that they call the builders. And we know like nothing about them other than they disliked fire and smoking.
Well, because you're in a cramped space. You know, as you see in Habbo Landing, fire bad, you know, like to borrow something from Frankenstein, fire bad. So, you know, with enclosed spaces, what it makes it sound like is that the builders are an enlightened type of society in the sense that they're aware of the, you know, health defects and secondhand smoke and things like that, that accompany cigarettes, putting thousands and, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in a 2x2x2 cube, and then having you smoke and burn fire and whatever else sounds like a terrible idea. And then they went out of their way to build stone, which could be, you know, the stone could be multifold in the sense that it's nearly indestructible. So it's almost, in my mind, it's almost certainly there to keep the critters out. Right, which is why they part of why they built the spires anyway. And then you also have the fact that it don't burn, so you know, so they're nearly indestructible and protect you from yourself in a way.
Yeah, and the spire stone itself, as Grimm described it, is very different apparently in the fact that it's all black and it's like never crumbling in any way. If any part of a spire is falling apart, it's always newer, different stone made things. So it's like these things have been lasting for who knows how long.
Right.
And
spire stone seems
they're never. Wrong. Yeah. It's, but what is this black substance that they're making spire stone out of? And why is it black?
Right. And yeah, so it depends on how sci-fi you want to take it, because, you know, it's almost certainly some kind of like, you know, future material that, you know, in a way, these things are impossible giant prefabs. You know, I doubt, like, you know, in some ways it could remind you of obsidian or maybe some other kind of volcanic rock or something like that. But, you know, like they have these huge structures. There's no way they were able to source all this material without going outside or, you know, creating it themselves or something. And to me, it always resonated that it was created. You know, it's not like somebody went and mined the stone and then built these things like Stonehenge or something. Like, it was created somehow. You know, so the things like that, if you push the builders too far out on the technological scale, you got to ask yourself what happened to them. Because they were around for a little while. They make it sound like the builders were real creatures. They were real people. They were there in the spires, but they never talk about what happened to them. Were they wiped out? Did they just die off? Did they leave? You know, are they the archangels or something else going on? You know,
could just be their ancestors, builders being another word for ancestors.
And I mean, that's a thing that I think too, but then I don't know of any historical way we could pull on an idea that society relapsed that far back? Like, what did they lose that drove them all but back to the Stone Age if the builders had this crazy awesome technology and they just, over hundreds of generations, lost the ability to do these things?
And seriously, how long would it take you to build a stone spire 10,000 feet in the air?
And dozens of them, at least, if not more.
Yeah, and presumably all by the same people, or the same group, or, you know, entity.
Right, and it could be that if they are just the predecessors, it could have been just, you know, that generation or that society or whatever as it crumbled around them. But that's why, like, maybe I should do some write-up or something for like a blog post and put it in the subreddit, because some of these things in my mind, like, I've got a bunch of answers that I'm working with in the meantime, and then we'll just see what happens when the next books come out, and that'll add shape to it. But it's like, to me, it was an Earth-like society. It maybe we'd say it's like approaching Star Trek level technology. They got hit with something or opened a portal or whatnot where the mist got involved. So the mist is some form of weaponization in my mind. And it basically started taking over the planet. And then eventually they realized they couldn't figure out a way to stop it. So they built these spires to kind of get away from it and to protect the remainder of their people. But yeah, I guess that's like a couple of sentences on, in my mind, that's some of the history of the world. But still, reading it the second time and getting a scope for the Predator's crystal has been around for 2,000 years. So this technology is ancient by any means, by any standard, you know. So it's pretty crazy to think about.
Yeah, and it's crazy to think of, like, there were these people who did this complicated thing, and they basically kind of formed the religion inside the spires, at least by the way that Gwen always swears by merciful builders and things like that. Like, but they're not, like, an established religion, and the fact that everyone still swears by God in heaven, that seems to be the way that they refer to that church, I'll call it. So they're not the same thing, but they are treated similar.
Right, they're deified. They're like, you know, they're kind of like angels, or they're something above the common man, right? I wouldn't necessarily say that they're gods, but they seem to know that there's something that was smarter / better than them that made all of this possible, and they have them to thank for it. But they were like, you know, they were mortal, right? So I think that's part of why they're not like worshipped or deified to that level. But yeah, the whole merciful builders things makes it sound like they're up here somewhere. So, and that's where it's like, well, if you start up here and then you come down here with like archangels, you know, where do they play on the same level? Are they the same thing, or if they something else similar? Because you've got God in heaven, you've got archangels, you've got merciful builders, then you've got the path, which, you know, is Eastern religion and stuff like that, you know, whether it's Buddhist or, you know, like Shaolin and stuff is what I think, because the Shaolin monks were like where they trained, they stomped divots into the stone where they train. And so when they talk about wearing the path, that's what it harkens back to, because Shaolin was also, you know, warrior monks basically, which the Weiists have some fighters for sure. So it's a little Kung Fu, it's a little Shaolin Kung Fu, and, you know, a little bit of Buddhist as well, maybe spun into it.
Yeah, I mean, the Shaolin similarity of the whole fighting monk thing is certainly there, but the language that they use, the Weiists, it does sound very Buddhist to me, and the fact that in Buddhism, there's like these paths, the Eightfold Path, and you're supposed to take the middle path, and I forgot a lot of the language, but it does harken very Buddhist to me, as well as like a mix of others, which kind of makes sense if everything got piled into one group and people just kind of formed religions out of that melting pot, literally. So,
right.
So we've covered spires and basically religion. Now we can get to other things that are even more dubious, like the magic system. We've talked about the Ethereus, and those are great. And how they use the ether is a little bit more confusing, I think.
Well, yeah, and so but the other thing too is that the magic system and their technology seem to go hand in hand as well, even to the point where Grimm uses that as an example, where it's like etheric engineers and etherealists are very similar in what they accomplish, but they do it through different means. Like the etherealists certainly use their body as part of it, where the etheric engineers, like Journeyman, yeah, like they are definitely the dwarves slash artificers slash, you know, like they use technology to manipulate etheric energies. And so it's all the same energy, but, you know, it's all, yeah, it's how they manipulate it is different. And that's pretty interesting to me. So I try not to think necessarily like magic versus technology, because in a way, in this world, they're the same. It's just how you access it.
One and the same, right? They both use it, but some people can do it with their bodies, like the etherealists. Now that the normal people need devices,
right,
or technology to interact with it,
right. And so, like a couple of details that I pulled out, you know, from this last time, like one of them is, so you've got to prime a gauntlet, you know, which I pretty much caught the first time. But the other thing is that they have firing cycles, and so I don't know if like it's mentioned that gauntlets, especially in other etheric weapons, generate tremendous amounts of heat, so that's why most of the gauntlet is copper, is to help diffuse that heat. But I don't know if that ties into their firing cycle as well, because they mentioned that ships can only fire so fast and whatnot, and then you've got like ripple fire and stuff like that, where you get into the tactics of the time and what makes sense for beating down shrouds and whatnot. But yeah, so there's a lot of interesting stuff there that in a lot of ways we don't know enough. Like, in order to know too much about the etheric technology, in my mind, we got to know what the ether stuff is, other than it's in like 80% of steampunk, right? So like etheric energy is just what, you know, they always called it the ether before they realized there's not actually a medium in space. You know, there isn't actually a gas or whatever in space. So it's kind of sourced from that idea. So is it electromagnetic radiation? Is it something else, you know, that has happened? And they make it, to me, it seems like it's tied to their star in a way, because they talk about having to have goggles, especially when they go outside and higher up. So etheric energy passes through all of the spire stone, and it passes through everything because they've got conduits inside, and it passes through people. Folly and Ferris talk about this at a couple of different points. But they only need goggles when they go outside. And the higher they go, the more likely it is to cause them to be crazy. So, like, the aeronauts have to take precautions against this.
Yeah, I mean, the goggles seem normal to me in the fact that, like, as you're losing protection from the sun, you need to be able to protect yourself, right, adding in goggles or suits and everything. That makes sense to me. But they didn't explain what kind of craziness would actually happen. So it kind of made me wonder if it's one of those not really crazies and people just get weird if they're out alone kind of in the middle of nowhere for a while.
And I think that's part of it, but it just occurred to me too that if it is literally etheric energy, maybe it's what happens to etherealists, except that you don't get superpowers, right? So it's what happens to normal people when etheric energy courses through them is it tears out little parts of their brain and their personality, so they go nuts like an etherealist, but they're just not as useful. Or maybe that's where etherealists come from, is that they Icarus, they try and touch the sky, and then, you know, it burns part of them up, and then they have to go get lumps of clay and two left slippers and, you know, all that jazz.
And we don't really know what causes the etherealism in people. Like, is it a genetic thing? I probably assume so, because lots of things are genetic. Or is it like an exposure thing? Again, we have no idea what causes the trait in people.
Right.
It could be that, like, if you just like expose a baby to it too much, then they'll grow up to be etherealist, or they're just born with it and you have a normal toddler until they start throwing things around with their mind.
Ugh. Maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's ethereal. I'll figure something out. So you know what I'm talking about, but, but yeah, so, I mean, so you've got, so not understanding the source for etheric energy. And in my mind, it's it's related to the star in some way. How they manipulate it into conduits and shit like that is part of the magic system of just like, it's not a technology that I know. So Clark's third law, if nothing else. But the other part is they grow shit. Like they grow crystals, they grow food, they grow meat. You know, like these technologies aren't lost to us, but the way that they affect it is hugely different. You know, so those are also things where it's like, how does this work? Because if I knew those two things, I'd be a lot further on what we could see in the future and so on. And maybe he doesn't know himself, but I have to hope he's got that outline somewhere.
Yeah. And so etherealists can do things with their crystals and stuff. And then somehow we in the spires have the technology to grow meat in vats. They don't need to kill anything. They just grow it like in a giant petri dish. That is intense.
Right. And the part that gets me the most about that, it's one thing to grow the meat, but they actually grow the meat in such a way that they still get leather out of it.
Yeah. And so like Bridget mentioned that she sends it to Tanner. It's like, how is this vat doing all of this? Right. Like, are they getting everything from it? Like, is the glass, are they growing glass in a vat, or are they gathering silica in some way in order to do it?
And apparently growing wood is a waste of time or too slow and expensive, you know, because they make such a big deal about how they go to the surface to get wood and whatnot.
How is it easier to grow meat in a vat when you can't grow wood in like a hydroponic system?
Right. And so you've got multiple batteries to help with the times. Like they mentioned at least Bridget's family, you know, with Wordkeeper and whatnot, her dad. And then there's at least one other that's like the main rival, because it's like, oh, they might buy us up or whatever and increase their standard that way. But it's also fast enough, right, compared to say crystals, where it takes years, if not generations, to build warship crystals. You know, so theoretically, the little lumen crystals, you know, maybe that takes a week or a month or something. The trim crystals, maybe that takes, you know, a couple of months, a year. But they seem to imply that it's generations of people to grow warship crystals. And then when you get to the power crystals, the older they get, the more efficient they get. So they continue to grow when they're outside of the solution. Because there's some solution, because they mentioned that for the lift crystal, that it's like, this shit's still got the solution on it. It's straight from the damn vat, you know, like, so.
Yeah, and how much are they getting from the vats? Like, if they're growing, say, beef in a vat, are they getting milk from a vat, or do they do without milk?
And if they do without milk, what do they put in their tea?
Exactly.
British people don't put milk in their tea, they put lemon.
Depends on the tea.
Yes, don't you just milk to their tea, they'll get mad.
Depends on the tea.
Well, and they certainly have honey, though, actually. So I guess that's right. They put honey in their tea because they make a big deal about how Grimm's got some, but it's like not very much and stale, perhaps. And then they
mention that he has cream. But it's kind of not very good anymore. So, like, they do have cream.
Right.
Where are they getting it?
Right. Yeah, like, they're probably not out grazing cows in the mist. You know, like, those seem like mutually exclusive things at this point.
Yeah, and these vats are amazing because exactly like that, you can't have a grazing area for cows. You just can't have that much livestock in a spire like that. So they worked around it in some amazing way.
Right.
They still can't, like, they can't do paper for some reason. Like, I figure for all the things, you might be able to make some sort of paper substitute out of a vat.
Right. Hopefully we get that answer someday, too. Like, there's just so many things. I feel like we've asked, like, 99 questions, and we've answered, like, two. So.
Have we answered any of them? Which ones did we answer?
There's only one guy with the answers, you know.
Right. Yeah, and if we had 15 books, we'd spawn off another podcast, probably.
Yeah. I mean, there's another thing, though, is that the silk. It's like they constantly talk about how the ether silk is really important, and the silk weavers are kind of one of the bad guy fodder, essentially. And so they can't grow it in a vat, apparently, because they need to harvest it from dangerous silk weavers. And people have tried for generations to domesticate them, and it's always ended with their faces getting ripped off.
Like thousands of years. Yeah.
Yeah. And so why can't they grow the ether silk? What is significant about that ether silk that allows them to work with the ether? Sure. Where do the silk weavers come from? How do they harvest it?
Right. And so, yeah, that's part of where it's like, to me, the silk weavers are, you know, they're like the Zerglings, right? Because I'm using half Diablo, half StarCraft to rationalize this in a way, is that the silk weavers were more or less the cannon fodder slash shock troops, but they just, the job is done. So they're just milling around, and maybe that's part of why they can't be domesticated, but they certainly are open to manipulation of the enemy, whatever that is. And Cavendish, she doesn't seem to do it on her own. She has that little ruby or crystal or whatever that she uses, but you know, they're open to manipulate, as opposed to most other people have to willingly give in, presumably. Like Cavendish had to accept something. Cause they talk about how she's a puppet and not really a person and stuff like that. But yeah, there's a lot, but that was one of the things I got in my notes, is that they failed to domesticate silk weavers for the last 2000 years. So the fact that Cavendish is able to do it is like fucking nuts, you know?
Yeah. And they deliberately, not really deliberately, but like pointedly have to depend on the silk so much.
Right.
That it's got some system of getting it so dangerously. Right. And there's another aspect that they're depending on, is that the metal that they have, they constantly point out how fragile iron is, that the iron rot happens almost immediately. But for one, where are they getting the iron? Are they growing that in a vat? I don't think it was specified. Or are they mining it somehow? And what about it is making it rot so fast?
That's so the where are they getting it's an amazing question that I hadn't fully thought of, because they also imply that all of their warships are heavily armored with presumably iron armor, and iron help provides some form of protection against etheric energy. And then, yeah, the iron rot, their copper clad weapons, because A, that's steampunk style, right? Because we've got to have our blends and our alloys and whatnot. But the iron rot, to me, that's what the mist is that the mist was weaponized in, you know, for two things in a way. Like, A, it cuts down your visibility to nothing on the surface, which presumably the monsters get an advantage. So silk weavers, mist moths, et cetera. And possibly that's like literally their atmosphere. So for us, it's just a mist, but maybe those creatures, there's something in the mist that they needed, like air or nutrients or something. That's part of my headcanon and like theory. And then I assume that the rust rot is because of the mist in some way, you know, because I'm still working under the assumption that this was a Earth-like planet, like, you know, take us 200 years in the future, 500 years in the future, and then some calamity happens. You know, that's my headcanon, where it was some near future, or, you know, perhaps even far future society, and we didn't win, you know. So you could go the tact from, you know, Stephen King's The Mist, where maybe they opened a portal to someplace they shouldn't have and the mist came in and they couldn't stop it. Or you could, you know, take the tact that it was like, you know, a weapon of some kind. And that's kind of my thing, because the enemy is clearly out there. There is some giant critter on the ground that, you know, can communicate with Cavendish telepathically and is hugely powerful telepathically, because they even try to squish Folly. Mm-hmm. And like, where did they came from? What's their thing? Are, you know, if you've played StarCraft, are they the Cerberus? Are they the Overmind? Are they the whatever? You know, like, I imagine they're still some middle tier creature. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been introduced to them. And so then you've got like Mist Maws and Silk Weavers are like two of the only creatures from the surface that we know of. But they make it sound like it's this vast jungle of eating your face, you know. Yeah. So
everyone is terrified of the surface and whatever is down there. But we see one enemy, essentially, and I don't really remember if it was even described other than just like a psychic force that was talking to Folly. And I have no idea what a mist maw looks like. Oh yeah, it had three eyes.
It had three eyes and it was like tall as a tower, I think. So Like it was supposed to be huge, I mean, from what I remember.
That might just be what it looks like in its set. It might be like a tiny monster beetle.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know, but what's a mist maw? I kind of assume something like a blue whale sized thing that's just out in the mist, somehow able to be buoyant and eats things. But I have no idea.
Right. Well, and for lack of any description or anything, mist maws, you'll love this reference too. Mist maws are like the flying whale shark things from Avengers. So the Battle of New York. They're the big critters with all the teeth, because they're fucking huge and they eat ships. You know, like certainly they eat destroyers, and they probably even give cruisers and other big ships a run for their money. So that's why you don't fuck around in the mist.
Yeah. I mean, mostly whatever it is, it's got to fly. It's got to have a big mouth.
Well,
that's
maybe
as far as the requirements go.
Yeah. Maybe it doesn't have to fly. Maybe it's just this big fucking worm that's like 2 miles long and eats spaceships. But
worm that comes out from the surface, right, 3 miles high, grabs the guys, it's terrifying.
Right. Well, and then think about that, and like, how are the spires still around if all this shit's running around? So, that's probably. Yeah, we'll go back to plan A, which is they're just really big flying worms instead of a terrifying three mile long worm.
Yeah. Okay, here's another weird issue of the spires. Where are they getting all of their light? They don't really describe how it looks in terms of light. They do assume like times and mornings and evenings all make sense. But, you know, if it's a spire, a circular thing, they've got limited areas for light to come in. They do mention ventilation shafts, but sunlight can't go that far. And the black stone is everywhere, which make it very cave-like. Mm-hmm. So are they creating artificial sunlight cycles somehow, or do they just do away with that entirely?
And the assumption is artificial, especially for something like Habble Landing, because they're very clearly, not only are they, you know, a cave, but they split the cave. So there's an artificial ceiling in there. So the assumption is etheric crystals. But it's like Habble Landing strikes me as all of the Victorian dark style stuff, where it's like, we're going to talk about Jack the Ripper. So everything is like gas lights, except it's etheric lights, right? So we've got gaslight level lights and the street. So that's to me what Habble Landing seemed like in my head, is that you're going to have dark, because even if you have all of these light sources, the black stone theoretically is going to absorb it to a level. But then Habble Morning, for example, by contrast, they have a dome, don't they? So
they have a glass dome.
Yeah, I thought they have some kind of clear spire stone that they get light in from there. So
I assume anything but the top one basically had some sort of artificial light, and it was always on, and they use clocks until day and night. I just know what time it is, you know, they have timepieces.
So circadian rhythms, bah.
Right.
Yeah, not circadian rhythms. That's what you get when you live in a tower hiding from monsters.
People don't do well without sunlight.
There was on the Vsauce. There's an experiment with a scientist who was put, I think, 3 months, like down in a cave, and she had like no access to like sunlight at all, or like only artificial light. And I think they also took away every timepiece. Like she had a computer, but it didn't have a timepiece or something. It was like removed somehow.
Yeah.
And she, her rhythm became like being awake for 24 hours and sleeping for 14 or something. That's like what she fell into. So maybe that's like the rhythm they have in anything but Habble Morning.
Right, and after 2,000 years in the spire, I'm sure they almost certainly changed. So, like, they adapted in some way. I mean, it's not going to be, like, evolutionarily necessarily, but, you know, in 3 months, this lady changed. If that's a legit thing, who knows? You know, maybe it's semi-fantasy, right? So maybe he's just, let's wave that away. That's not important to the story, so I'm not going to address it so much. But yeah.
Right. It just kind of stands out. I mean, people don't do well without sunlight for a long period of time. They're rhythms will change and they'll be able to function, but like vitamin D deficiency?
Right. Yeah. I was telling Amber that when I was in the middle of the reread that I was like, where the hell are they getting their water from? Mm-hmm. Where do they shit? You know? And basically the hand wavy way of that is that, so the spire is a cylinder inside of a square, inside of a cube, and all of that extra space that's carved out in the corners is all of the incidentals. It's all of the life support stuff. So it's like, so are they, is it all compost and water filtration and pulling water from the surface? Does it pull it from the mist directly? Like, where do they get all this? Do they just build water because they've got giant tanks of hydrogen and oxygen? I mean, what? Like, there's a trillion questions for stuff like that on the logistics side of it beyond, like, how'd they get wood? And why can't they just grow it? It's like, how are they alive? It's been 2,000 years. Where do they get the water? Where'd all the shit go?
I mean, presumably they know how to grow tea, considering they all depend on tea.
Right.
Okay, so they can do that, I'm assuming, in some form of hydroponics. But they can't do wood because I guess wood is just too difficult or too big or something. But they still need the water.
If anything, I think the reason they don't grow wood and why wood is expensive and why they have to get it from the surface is that it requires too much space.
So I have two thoughts on that. Space was definitely one of them, so I agree with that. The other thing is the builders are against fire, right? So maybe they just didn't build wood because they didn't want you to be an idiot and build a bunch of wood things. So maybe they had already seen like the Habbo Landing thing, like in their mind's eye, they planned for it. And maybe that's why they can't grow wood, is because it doesn't seem like they're building any new technologies. They're just using the machines or mechanics that were left to them by the builders. And the builders are like, fuck cigarettes, so no tobacco, and fuck wood, because don't burn the place down.
All right. How do they cook? I'm assuming they're using crystals that make electricity, but that doesn't... Grilling still happens, right?
No, that's an amazing question, too, because like they kind of bring that up with the airships towards the end. Like when Cavendish comes to the airship and has tea, they have an argument about electricity being the hot new thing and how airships have these plug-in appliances and everybody should have them. And so they don't have hot plates. Yeah. They have to either burn wood or coal or something, right? Or they have crystals, like you said, but it's implied that they don't, that electricity is the new hotness. Oh, man, I don't know.
How are people cooking for 2,000 years if they're not using fire?
And it's not like they didn't go to that damn, dumpling shop like 14 times in the story.
they're on a paleo diet, or Stone Age diet. What's one where they can't have been heated above something?
Paleo, except for they mentioned the dumplings were really hot, therefore they cooked it, therefore not paleo. Right? I think I understand my fad diets.
Hot. Paleo can be cooked. I think you just stick to like meats and stuff like that.
Keto, so.
There's some diet where it can't have been above X degrees.
Yeah, because they decided that means cooked instead of dehydrated.
Wow.
Fad diets are weird, and a lot of them are very dumb. So I'm assuming that all of Spire Albion is not on a fad diet, and somehow they're still cooking.
Look,
they're still boiling water.
Clearly, somehow. The builders cared about your health, so they instituted no smoking and a paleo diet, and that's why everybody's so ripped because they all do CrossFit.
So, also, how are they getting their beer? Because I know people are drinking alcohol.
Well, if you can grow tea,
is
you
that
can grow
grown
hops.
In a vat?
If you could grow tea, you could grow hops, right?
Hops
and
is
gross. They have vats, so they have, places to grow.
Do
the
they
beer.
Have barrels that they can age whiskey in?
Well, and that's a great question too, because doesn't Grimm have some kind of brandy on the ship? So,
yeah. They have alcohol that requires aging, and are they doing that in barrels, or are they doing it something else?
Right. In Spirestone. Yeah. Right. Like, they went down to the surface to fucking cut a tree down to make a barrel to age whiskey in it. So, like, those guys are making bank.
Or this whiskey is a pleasant taste of stone. Ew, gross. Yeah, it's so many questions when you build something like a spire, as like people are living here for 2,000 years. Okay, how? It just, that question needs to be answered.
Yes. Yep. And now we've got 20 more questions at a minimum that we didn't know. Yeah, because the light cycles definitely bothered me, but I kind of skipped and substituted that fact into, like, you know, there's a lot of Victorian era mystery stuff where it's like you never see the light of day, even though you know they're on Earth and they have light cycles. But the whole movie's in rain in the dark because noir and, you know, whatever genre for the times and whatnot. But yeah, like long-term health things, it seems like this is like eventually you're going to lose, and how you survive for 2,000 years instead of like 20 is kind of beyond me.
I mean, they might not have the same biology we do. They might be human-like, but not human.
Oh, they're not humans. That does solve a lot of things. Yeah. It just, there's a lot of questions, and we have very little answers, because we have one book, which, granted, it was very long and very enjoyable, but it didn't have a chance to answer everything. And the next book isn't going to have a chance to answer everything either. We might get a few more cultures. We might get a little bit of explanation of history, but...
It is a lot easier with stuff like the Dresden Files, where, granted, there's magic and shit, but he only has to explain the magic stuff because all the human stuff we already know.
And yeah, then urban fantasy, it does have that advantage.
And it's
a lot harder. You know, high fantasy has the advantage of just like, it doesn't matter because I get to hand wave everything. You just need to actually explain it at some point.
Right, which... there's no way he's going to answer all of the questions we've raised in these two shows in the next book, but I'm hoping we're going to get like a good percentage of them. I hope we're going to get more of the geopolitics, which almost certainly we are. I hope we get, you know, I mean, we're going to get to theoretically see how another spire lives. So mm-hmm. like what's different about the Olympians? Are they also polite, or are they all like the Commodore where he's like, there's half as many of them, but they break people's faces when they're pissed off, you know, like, let's do this, you know? So, because that's the other thing, like, he was Olympian, right? But it's also implied that he was a berserker of some kind, where it's like he's possessed of a certain kind of fury, and he's wearing animal skins, I thought.
And, Aurora? No, wait.
No, Aurora? This is the Commodore that helped them fight off the Silk Weavers. The Matriarch Silk Weaver in the inn. So he was arguing because Gwen bought his room out from under him. So I can't remember the dude's name, but.
Let's see. I'm sure I can find it in a minute because the wiki is just so helpful, even though it is so empty.
Oh, it's so sad.
Commodore Horatio Pine. Right. That's a very English name.
Oh, yeah. And that was one of the things that I thought, too. I was like, really? Horatio Pine, like that's a very not Greek name.
Also, they mention a sculptor named Mick Daggett, which is still very British-ish. So, are these people Greek or not?
So Mick Daggett is Olympian?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
From so says where? The wiki. Like, blame them if I'm...
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because I was like, they kind of talk about some sculpting and art that the Spire Arc had, but that's all I remember.
Okay, so their clothing description is Olympians wear traditional green and gold clothing. Many wear the devices of their home spire's laurel wreath upon their breast or pendants or rings. The laurel wreath they usually associate with Romans. So maybe they're not Greek.
Or like, yeah, still, toga parties.
Maybe that's a very English name.
Maybe it's reverse conquest. It's still over in the Mediterranean area, but like Albions conquered them or something. Instead of, you know, what happened in our world where the Romans conquered half of
everywhere
Britain.
Else.
So,
well, and specifically half the world, really.
Well, yeah, like details.
Scale, who cares? Jeez. I want them to be Greek. I want them to be different. But they're going to end up being English, probably, apparently, based on those names.
I mean, it's not exactly the first time Jim didn't really consider what names he chose.
That's not fair.
Consider them.
How many M's do we have?
I mean, he's drawn to M's. But why did he use Gwendolyn Margaret?
Some things get away from him a little bit, but like, yeah, Maggie, Margaret, Molly.
It's also Margaret. God, that drives me nuts.
Right.
But all right. Are we running out of things with Cinder Spires? Are this part two closed?
I think part two is closed. And I mean, there's still plenty to talk about, but like, yeah, I don't know if we should do a part three because the plenty to talk about is like, oh man, we didn't talk about the airships nearly enough because shields and phasers and stuff, man.
And the webs and how they turn and all of their things. Like, yeah, that's right. That's fun, but maybe wait until the next book.
We can save it.
I kind of think what we should do is the next time we have Jim on, which was around after Peace Talks, he said he would come on again. We should make it like a 2-hour special, 1 hour or 2 hour Resident Files, and then like some time for Aurora, World of Cinder Spires.
Or yeah, we could just have him on for time. Peace Talks, and then we could have him on again in a year when he finishes the Olympian Affair.
Yeah, we'll but the problem is we already got so many questions now. After the Olympian Affair, we'll probably have more, and he only has so much time at one time. So maybe we should like split it up. Have him on like in the like once a month. That sounds good.
Okay,
that would be good. Every other episode, it's like Jim, give us answers.
Questions for you. Aren't you tired of doing it at cons only? Let's do it now here, now online too.
Yeah. Speaking of, if you guys didn't see that in the chat, in the next year he will be in Salt Lake or near Salt Lake twice. So take that, suckers. So maybe I need to start going to some of these panels and be like, hey, answer questions. So
I don't know why you would go to Salt Lake even once or near Salt Lake. Who even lives there anyway?
Well, Mormon? there's a couple of million people here, but yeah. It's no New York, but still.
Yeah, well, we're 6 million people here.
What, your whole country?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Right. So you can find everything of our stuff at brokenjars.xyz. And if you like high fantasy stuff, you can listen to my podcast, High Fantasy, which I got to talk to Daniel Wilson, PhD of robotics, that also writes about robots and robopocalypses. And that was fun. That's going to drop on August 1st because that's when the new book drops that you should also really read before you listen to that episode because we spoiled pretty much everything. Yeah, that was fun. And then we've got things like Great Scott, which they're somewhere in season 5, last I knew. And what else we got?
So you guys are so unhelpful. So High Fantasy, Dangerous to Go Alone, Great Scott. The Long Haul, what's going on with that one?
It's new. I haven't had a chance to listen to him yet, but I think it's about gaming and families. Like, at what age should you let your kid play this? Or was it like playing video games with your kids, I think? Which could be fun. But yeah, so we've got a new one, and I think that's it now, right?
I think so.
All right. So yeah, everything you want to possibly find of us is at brokenjars.xyz. So, and a Patreon, if you really want to be nice and have a sticker or a few other bonus gifts that we have. Okay. Bye, everyone. Thank you for listening.
Bye, everyone.